that system is generating horrible backlashes from white males who feel displaced from the labor market, from whites who feel displaced by immigrants and black folks in the job market. It's irresistible for certain parts of the capitalist elite to plug into those resentments and use them to impose an authoritarian regime which just gets rid of the facade of bourgeois democracy.
Welcome to the Deep Focus Show. I'm Professor Richard Wolff, and I will be a guest host for the month. Thank you very much for joining us. And please like, subscribe, and share so that we can continue to bring you this kind of in-depth conversation. Joining me today is Paul Street, historian and author of many books, including one that I know called This Happened Here, Americaners, Neoliberals, and the Trumping of America, a wonderful title that carries a lot of wisdom that we have learned to appreciate with the passage of time. Paul holds a doctorate from Binghamton University and has taught U.S. history at numerous institutions, colleges, universities in the Chicago area. He is a regular contributor to Counterpunch, Z Magazine, ZNet, Agenda Report, Common Dreams, and his Substack is called The Paul Street Report. There he provides commentary on current events. He's also a member of the executive board of the national organization called Refuse Fascism. So first of all, Paul Street, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Very happy to be here, Professor.
All right, I'm going to start with an article you wrote in Counterpunch, in which you responded to, in a critical vein, the work of Timothy Snyder, in particular his book called On Tyranny. And there are two points you made that I would like to hear you expand a bit on within the limits of the time that we have. One is that, quote, Trump is contributing to the downfall, either of the American empire or maybe of America, period. And the second point is that the decline of the empire, in your judgment, is not something we should be mourning. Could you tell us what you meant by those criticisms in the light of Mr. Snyder's work?
Well, I didn't necessarily mean a criticism of the notion that Trump is doing things contributing to the decline of the American empire, but I did have a criticism of the notion that this is necessarily something bad or something that we should mourn. Certainly much of the human population across planet Earth has a different perspective on it. And, you know, Snyder went through some things that make a certain amount of sense. He talked about Trump privileging personal enrichment of himself and his family and cronies and building a cult around himself over, you know, sustaining longstanding institutions of a coherent imperial state. And I think that's happening. He talked about Trump interfering with proper succession in the imperial elite by questioning past and future elections. He talked about how Trump seems to, compared to all of his predecessors, lack a coherent kind of imperialist ideology to justify and guide the nation's position in the world. And, you know, America, Trump's America First foreign policy does seem like a kind of unpredictable grab bag of deals and military interventions subject to the dear leader's whims and his lust for wealth and power rather than any real, you know, serious effort at making a kind of argument for American world leadership. Snyder seems upset that he literally, it says Trump is failing to defeat adversaries, you know, and he talks about losing a trade war with China and then a war with Iran and how both of these are leading to the enrichment of Russia. He's shredding essential alliances. He's attacking science and education and surrendering green energy leadership and development and thus the future to China. I mean, these are things that are happening. And, you know, whether this is something to be mourned or not depends, I think, to no small extent on your perspective. Now, you know, my main point is that given the very grisly record of American empire, much of humanity has some pretty doggone good reasons not to mourn declining U.S. power. There's an interesting book that came out, disturbing book, from Monthly Review Press a year or so ago called Endless Holocausts. And in that, political scientist David Michael Smith calculates that the U.S. has been responsible or shared responsibility for the deaths of 54 million people between 1945 and 1920. And if you add in domestic social killing, you know, the Native American genocide, the many people who died under slavery and so forth, and you go all the way back to the beginning of the country, he's got a body count that climbs as high as 300 million. We have overthrown dozens of governments, interfered with dozens of elections, tried to assassinate more than 50 foreign leaders, bombed more than 30 nations, moved to suppress nationalist, leftist, populist movements in many, many, many countries. This has been a background to the foreign policy story, the imperial story of my entire life in the United States of America. This is the only country that ever actually attacked civilians with atomic weapons, and quite unnecessarily so. You know, it's a clear leader in the global march to a kind of societal collapse, if not human extinction, according to now volumes and volumes of earth science and weapons research and epidemiological research. And stuff that's coming out about the potential impact of artificial intelligence, and not just a recent development, this imperialism. I mean, I really think people should watch the Ken Burns 6-part series on the American Revolution, PBS. I'm not a big fan of Ken Burns' history, but it's very good. And one of the things that emerges very clearly from it is that this country, in its very founding, is not only genocidal toward its Native American people, white supremacist towards its main profitable labor supply, black chattel slaves, militantly patriarchal towards women, but aggressively and self-consciously imperialist, literally from day one. The Continental Congress, the Continental Army. Now, you can be left and hate all of this and oppose it, all this history of imperialism, and still be worried about the decline in terms of what it could mean in terms of chaos and disintegration for humanity. And for an example, the very good scholar Alfred McCoy is also very worried about China as the next hegemon. And it gets kind of worried at one point he agrees with this history, and on the other hand is concerned about what it means in terms of what's next. But I don't think most of humanity is going to mourn the decline of U.S. hegemony given this track record. I mean, we have the highest carbon footprint by far per capita on planet Earth as we approach the precipice of a climate catastrophe. It's a bit of a long-winded answer to your question, Professor.
I'd like to pick up on a term that is thrown around more these days than it has been in the past, and that is the term fascism or fascist. And here, what I'm interested in is, do you think that that word is applicable either to where we are in the United States or where we seem to be heading? And if you do, could you help us distinguish this kind of fascism here from what we saw, for example, in Germany and Italy 75 years ago?
Fascism, I think the first thing to keep in mind about it is it is a change in the political superstructure, a new form of governments atop a persistently capitalist system, if you want to call it a mode of production or whatever. The underlying material economy stays in private hands, but there's a fundamental change in the governance regime. At Refuse Fascism, and I've participated to some degree in these definition formations, we see fascism as genocidal racism, white supremacism, plus militant patriarchy, misogyny, plus xenophobic nationalism, all combined with and reinforcing each other, but harnessed to the project of building a new form of governance, a dictatorship beyond previously normative rule of bourgeois democracy, rule of law, deliberation, and all that. It's really the rule of violent and irrational men replacing the rule of law and elections. It's it has an energy, a kind of counter, a juggernaut feel and a counter-revolutionary active energy that's not really captured properly by just the phrase authoritarianism. And authoritarianism, it not only is kind of static, but doesn't quite capture the social historical content of the racism, the patriarchy, and the nativism. I would say potentially headed towards the consolidation of that as a new, durable, superstructural form atop American capitalism. That could happen. Whether it happens or not, it's up to millions of us, and whether we're really going to get serious about acknowledging the threat and taking it on. And it is, of course, different in many ways than classic European historical fascism, which a lot of scholars have taken the differences to mean that it can't possibly be, at least in the past they have taken these differences to mean that it can't actually be fascism. If it's not a perfect match with Mussolini's Italy or Hitler's Germany, well, there are real differences, to say the very least. European classic fascism was arguably responding to an actual revolutionary Marxist proletarian threat after World War I and during the Great Depression. It took place in a period of time when there was an actual socialist state, flawed though it may have been, an actual alternative socialist state that particularly German fascism was taking direct aim at, with much support from the rest of the capitalist world. We have not seen a fully consolidated fascism in the United States right now. It's a potential threat. It's a real, we are at a very pivotal moment right now in the wake of these attacks on voting rights, if you ask me. But I mean, German fascism, according, you know, if you read Peter Fritsch's book, Hitler's First 100 Days, seems to be largely consolidated and having taken hold with the majority of the citizenry as early as May 1st of 1933. That clearly hasn't happened. Fascism, I call it Americaner fascism because I'm playing off South African apartheid, the highly racialized sort of third world fascism that ruled South Africa for years. I think the American fascism leads more with race and gender than it does with the classic historical model of the bourgeoisie hiring the fascists to destroy the Marxist and other left radical proletarian forces. This is a fascism taking place at the end of, but maybe still in, a neoliberal era. It is not building up any social safety nets or expenditures for masses of working class people. It's pretty much screwing them over and continuing and worsening a project of deepening misery and economic immiseration. And actually, there was some uplift under German fascism, and many of the people were reemployed. There was some expansion of social benefits. These are, and there are more and other differences. I mean, the German fascism was connected to a massive territorial war campaign, the territorial expansion against a near neighbor, the Soviet Union, and ends up culminating in literal genocide. Okay, as that war is activated against the Soviet Union, and so there's differences.
Let me push you a little bit in one direction. I mean, there are too many interesting things raised by your comment, but let me put it this way. Do you think Mr. Trump is leading us towards a fascist potential future, or do you think of fascism as somehow structural emerging in the country so that Trump is a feature of it rather than it being a feature of Trump?
Yeah, I would see Trump as a feature of it. He is not a classically trained, intellectually sophisticated, doctrinal fascist like Mussolini or Hitler. You know, and that's one of the key differences. He is incredibly avaricious and corrupt in a way that previous fascist leaders weren't. But there's a regime behind him. There are self-conscious fascists who are moving to entrench a post-democratic, post-liberal, post-rule of law state. The Project 25, 26 people, certainly Russell Vought, certainly Stephen Miller, and others. Yes, there's a movement afoot. There are people in the Supreme Court that are moving to entrench and lock in a post-civil rights, post-voting rights, post-diversity, post-bourgeois democracy America. And they're moving rather quickly. And I think, yes, it would survive. I would survive Trump. It's beyond him. They've tapped him. He has had some sort of magical relationship with the base. And I don't know if they think they can, these people who are engineering this on the far right, if they can replicate that with a Vance or a Rubio. They're going to try. I mean, Trump certainly seems like he's living on fumes right now. He's not in very good shape.
All right, good. This is exactly what I was trying to get at. How strong, and I know this is a difficult question, but how strong do you think the support is in the United States at this time for that movement, of which you've just said Trump is merely a symbol or a symptom or being carried along? All right, let's leave Trump. How deep is the movement for a post-liberal, post-democratic system in the United States, in your judgment?
Well, that's pretty hard to judge, but there does seem to be about a good quarter of the population that's just kind of dug in, that there's just no rational arguing with. I mean, it just seems to me like there's a type of predominantly rural or ex-urban part of the population, not exclusively, some suburbanites, and even run into a few in the cities, that is okay with $10 a gallon or $15 a gallon or $20 Big Macs, you know, as long as Black people are being disenfranchised and tens of thousands of brown people are being swept up into an expanding network of concentration camps. Just how many these people really are. I mean, we have a big structural problem with our constitutional bourgeois democracy insofar as people with these attitudes are disproportionately empowered, because we disproportionately empower through our gerrymandering and through our Senate structure and through our, to some extent, through our federal states' rights system. We disproportionately empower a very revanchist minority of the population. So even a quarter is not to be taken lightly. You know, I mean, it's a hell of a thing. And what we're going to do with that, if we ever get past this thing, what we're going to do with these folks is an interesting question.
Have they generated a counter movement? Do you see an anti movement that sees what you've just described, sees it in the way you've just described it, and is beginning to mobilize either to stop that or else and or push for a different future?
So we've had some remarkable courageous uprisings, but they've tended to be localized, like Minneapolis, which was extraordinary. But what we saw in Chicago, and I participated in some of that, was really quite extraordinary too. But tending to say ICE out of Chicago or ICE out of Minneapolis, falling short of, oh, ICE is, if we push them out of here, then they're going to go somewhere else. How about ICE out of the whole country? And how about understanding ICE and Border Patrol as, in a sense, the SS and the Gestapo, the paramilitary police force of the authoritarian dear leader? There's some movement towards that. And when you talk to people at these events, or you go to the No King's Day rallies and you say, you know, this is actually a dictatorship in formation and this leader has to go, people tend to agree with that. They're not quite ready to go there now, that the movement we have needs to be beyond 9 million people one day, once every 5 months. It needs to become millions of people every day and take on the character of anti-authoritarian movements in the Philippines that overthrew Marcos, or in Bulgaria recently, or in South Korea, where we're actually saying, this is unacceptable. This is an existential threat to democracy, rule of law. environmental sustainability, nuclear sanity, pandemic and public health protection, not just in the U.S., but in the whole planet. We're not quite there yet. There's a lot of agreement with it. But there's still a faith in fighting this thing through the very institutions that they are tearing up. And I don't mean to sound condescending against lawsuits and against voting and all of that. People are going to do those things, are going to need to do those things, but they are systematically tearing up a lot of the usual normal mechanisms of citizen self-defense. And we have yet to graduate. We have refused fascism. We've had some interesting moments. When we go to a highway in Chicago and put up a banner that say this regime must go right now, people just honk their horns. They just go, they go like crazy. I went to a demonstration. I went to a vigil in Iowa City at the VA after Alex Priddy was killed. And this lady, everything was very quiet and very peaceful and was very just focused on ICE and what they did. And she showed me her handmade poster. And I said, but you know, it's more than that. It's a whole regime. And she kind of sheepishly turned around her poster and said, this is what I wrote on the other side. The dictator must go now. That sentiment is out there. And I suspect it's going to deepen with the attack on the elections that's taking place. There is a very, very serious, and this is a place where Tim Snyder and I agree. There is a very, very serious campaign being undertaken against the midterm elections. It's many-sided, and it's not just about the voting rights and gerrymandering. It includes a whole bunch of things. And this is a pivotal moment as we confront what they're doing with the elections and where are we going to go with that.
I want to go with a little bit of time we have left, Paul, back to something you said earlier, which was, you pointed out that at the root of many of these issues was the capitalist system. And I want you to finish this limited thing that we can do on this program today by telling us a little bit more about that. And here's what I mean. Should we see, in your view, should we see Trump, the tendencies towards fascism, the threat to our elections that you just mentioned, should we see these as reflections or consequences of a capitalism that is in trouble? Or is it connected to capitalism in some other way?
I think it's connected to capitalism fundamentally, but then it gets exacerbated by capitalism in trouble. When you go back to the definition that I gave of fascism, this combination of white supremacism, sexism, xenophobic nationalism, you could throw in other things, fundamentalism and palingenetic ultranational. Those are things that, particularly the racism, the nativism, the sexism, that I think have lives of their own historically, but then are essentially poured into the very foundation of capitalism. They are transformed by capitalism. They in turn transform capitalism. They become dialectically inseparable from it. They become part of it. And that's on one hand. On the other hand, you have a system called capitalism that historically has promoted itself as a agent and champion of democracy and popular governance, right? In its bourgeois revolutions and vis-a-vis the regimes that had existed before, but that constantly, through its inherent tendency towards the concentration of wealth and power, delegitimizes democracy and renders the democratic rhetoric and promises of even liberal presidents and senators inauthentic in the eyes of millions of people. So you're sort of upholding democracy and then rendering it inauthentic, but you have an anarchic system of competitive warfare between firms, between people, between nations that is constantly generating crises, big crises, ecological crises, business cycle crises, booms and busts. and inter-imperial conflicts between competing capitalist classes. It's constantly creating crisis, creating gigantic human traumas. Now we're looking at AI. We're dealing with pandemics that require big government intervention. But you have delegitimized democracy. So you've opened the door through the intervention of authoritarians who say, I alone can fix this. And there are different types of authoritarianism, but the type of authoritarianism that's plugging into racism, sexism, and nativism is the fascist variant of it. And as you see the United States running out of global space and frontier space to just buy people off with, as it comes up against the limits of its economic power in a world system that's seeing the rise of China as a potential new hegemon, and you see a kind of scarcity logic and an inability to expand benefits to smooth over the very conflicts of race and class and ethnicity and gender that it is generating. And that system is generating horrible backlashes from white males who feel displaced from the labor market, from whites who feel displaced by immigrants and black folks in the job market. It's irresistible for certain parts of the capitalist elite to plug into those resentments and use them to impose an authoritarian regime which just gets rid of the facade of bourgeois democracy.
Let me ask you a question kind of out of the blue, but I don't think so altogether. Many people have been writing to me over the last 6 months asking me a question I'm going to pass to you. They've noticed that the United States no longer has its Navy boarding ships that might be carrying drugs to carry out an inspection, and if they are, arrest them, and all of that. Instead, the United States government is summarily executing boat after boat, each of them with half a dozen fishermen or whoever they are in there. No arrest, no jury, no judge, no evidence. And then the ultimate, even if they were found guilty here in the United States, where we arrest people for drug traffic all the time, it's not a capital crime. We don't kill anybody because of it. How do you understand the systematic killing of people who we would not kill if they were arrested in our country? We would not deprive them of jury trial, of confronting their accusers, and all the rest of the most basic rights of the individual fought for centuries. What's going on?
Well, these are extrajudicial executions on the high seas. And this is characteristic of a fascist form of foreign policy. Trump and Hegseth last September invited 800 flag officers, admirals and generals from across the American empire to get a lecture in the auditorium of Quantico, of the Marines base there, in which they said, we will no longer, particularly Hegseth said this, we are no longer bound by obsolete, woke rules of international human rights and wartime law, like the Geneva Convention. He actually says we are going to replace a tepid legality with maximum lethality. This is long before the war on Iran. This is last September. It was followed immediately by these escalated boat strikes. Like, I have to check back and see if they were underway already. By the way, this is also where Trump told the 800 plus generals that the top adversaries in the United States of America were not abroad, but were actually the enemy within, meaning anyone left of him and Pete Hegseth. And I mean, the thought that they would do that, and this is before Iran, the madness of the Iran war, and then subsequently literally seize the elected sovereign head of a foreign state and put him in a jail cell in Brooklyn and then command that state to hand over their petroleum resources. This is the kind of savage, barbarian, blitzkrieg type of warfare that the Third Reich was about, and it's quite menacing, and it's Snyder would probably see this, and he'd be right, as a kind of a sacrifice of any pretense of soft power and democratic legitimacy. It is a decision to rely on pure raw force. And I'll never forget Stephen Miller as this was going on being interviewed about it, and he said, people are just going to have to understand that what really happens in history is the rule of force, the social Darwinian power of force beneath and beyond the nice little pretty woke liberal leftist niceties of international and national law. And that's what this is. This is a defining aspect of fascism, the transcendence of the rule of law, the rule of a violent and irrational men relying on pure force.
It's a very sobering assessment of what this represents. Sounds to me, if I could comment on it, that things may be further along in that movement that you talked about at the beginning of our conversation in a direction that ought to motivate Americans to, you know, wake up and see which way things are going. The ability of Hegseth and Trump to use this language of woke, you know, is ironic. We have to now get woke about that usage of woke so that we are not, you know, kind of half asleep, led down the path. You know, the metaphor of sleep always brings back George Carlin, who commented on the American dream, that of course it's called the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it.
There you go. Yeah.
All right, Paul, we've come to the end of our time for today. I want to thank you again for joining me on this show. Paul Street, author and historian. You can follow his work on his Substack, The Paul Street Report. As I mentioned, I'm Richard Wolff, and I will be guest hosting Deep Focus for the month. Thank you for joining us. Please remember to like, subscribe, and share so that we can continue developing and bringing these programs to you. And you can also find my work if you're interested. Likewise, on YouTube and Substack, Democracy at Work is the way we call what we do. Thank you very much, and I look forward to speaking with you again in the future.